Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, welcome. We're going to start with a short clip of film which features a British comedian and a Norwegian opera singer. No prizes for guessing who the latter is. I think we'll just show it to you and I'll tell you the rest about it later.
Ladies and gentlemen, it isn't often that I have the privilege of introducing such a distinguished artist as Madame Kirsten Flagstaff, star of the Metropolitan Opera Company. Madame Flagstaff has been acclaimed the world's greatest living soprano. She will sing an aria from Richard Wagner's opera, The Valkyrie, Brunhilde's battle cry. Mr. Wilfred Pelletier of the Metropolitan will conduct it.
I think that's what we call in the theatre a very late tab cue. They only just managed to get the opening time to catch up. That was from a film called The Big Broadcast of 1938, which was a sort of potpourri of all the things which had caught American middle brow taste during that year previously. There was a whole series of events in it. And what's interesting about that is that, A, it's introduced by Bob Hope, who is also from another country, who is, of course, English, comes from Eltham in Kent. And he was absolutely loved and in raptures with American audiences and they with him. And so was Kirsten Flagstaff, who, of course, came from, you know, a completely different culture and art. But it's interesting that in the 30s in America, I thought that these two people were snapped up and sort of taken up. And they both came from nowhere to kind of star in the American media world. Because what happened with Kirsten Flagstaff was that she had started with a little career in Norway, which is fairly local. And she was in lots of not only operettas but also musicals. She was a bit of a hoofer girl. She was sort of quite a trooper for that thing. Gradually, that expanded a bit to the point at which she was appearing in sort of neighbouring Sweden, and she started to sing bigger opera roles. But it was still a fairly local event. Then she was spotted when she was singing first big Wagner role, Isolde, in Oslo by a Norwegian singer who was already well established in the Wagner world, who recommended her to the Wagner family in the Bayreuth festival, and she got an audition and she sang three small parts in two successive Bayreuth festivals. Now, the whole time this was going on, she was getting letters from New York saying, "We've heard about you, we'd like to hear you." She wasn't remotely interested. She thought there was no chance that she would ever achieve anything in the Metropolitan or anything on that kind of level. She was also quite a housebody, or what would we say, a homebody. So she was quite interested in being at home with the children, with her husbands, and just staying and being quiet. So the Metropolitan got golden chance, she just pushed completely to one side. But eventually, she was talked into doing an audition for them, and she went on a famous occasion into this hotel room in St Moritz, and she sang this huge repertoire to them, mostly from the book, because she didn't have it in her off by heart at that point. And the thing about the room was that it was a small hotel room, and it was absolutely stacked with heavy curtains, so the sound was amazingly sort of deadened. So the whole impact of her voice didn't really come across to the Metropolitan audition team. Anyway, at the end they decided they would take her, but it was rather a sort of faux demure basis. And they said to her, they left her with the famous thing saying, two instructions, number one, don't get fat, because we would never employ you if you were fat. And make sure you know the following roles off by heart before you step off the boat in America. And they then proceeded to list all the major Wagner roles, every single one, including the role of Isolde complete, which was quite an achievement at that time to actually do that. Also Beethoven's Leonora from Fidelio, also the Marschallin from Strauss's Rosenkavalkade, which she never actually did. And those were the conditions, and she was sent to Prague to coach with this rather ferocious conductor, who was already at that stage a ferocious conductor, called George Sell, who is one of the big martinets of the classical world. And he said nothing to her. They coached away on all these Wagner roles he played. She sang, he said absolutely nothing until just the last lesson before she was due to go to America. And he said, well, I think you'll be able to fulfil the conditions they've asked you for. So she felt kind of relieved by that. So anyway, she ships to America, and when she starts to sing in the house, when she starts to sing in rehearsals with orchestra in the Metropolitan Auditorium, it's of course the first time that the people auditioning her originally have really heard the size of this voice, which was one of the big features of it. And the conductor, Artur Batansky, who is rather underrated these days, I think, but is actually one of the great followers of Mahler, and sort of learnt a great deal from Mahler. We can hear Batansky conducting on many of the early recordings of Flagstaff, taken down from live broadcasts, and I think that actually gives us a connection to the way in which Mahler conducted Wagner. So that's rather interesting. Anyway, here was Batansky conducting her in a rehearsal of actually Götterdämmerung, and he just couldn't believe what he was hearing, and he called for the manager of the Metropolitan to come and hear what they'd got. And they decided to start cautiously at first. I mean, cautiously compared with the size of the repertoire she was taking on. And they put her on as Sieglinde in the Walküre. And this performance, as many performances at the Met in those days started to be, was broadcast throughout the whole of America and to other parts of the world as well. And this was the thing which lit the blue torch paper for Flagstaff's career. So let's hear a little bit of her singing Sieglinde. This is Du bist der Lenz. what everybody talked about at first, and perhaps what everybody talks about now, is the sheer size of the voice. But that, in a way, that interests me less than this rather remarkably intimate quality she brings to such big music. It's always to me like she's singing songs. Later on today, we'll hear some of the songs that she took on tour with her. And there's something about the way in which she presents these big situations, which is very intimate and homely. I mean, very folksy. And I mean, when I say folksy, I don't mean that at all in any kind of patronising way. Naturally from a culture which can relate easily to the stories which Wagner told in these big operas, particularly, of course, in the Ring there. And I think that's a very interesting quality with her. And the other thing, which we'll pick up a little on later, is that at this point in her career, which, although she was in her early 40s, but it was relatively quite early in terms of her. I mean, it would be late for some singers, but it was early for her. She also, there's a freshness about the voice which we don't quite hear in the recordings made after the war. And that freshness particularly comes when she's working with this American pianist and conductor called Edwin MacArthur, who became a regular friend of hers and her regular accompanist. And in fact, she risked a lot to try and get him a job as a bigger conductor than he was probably ready to be. But when she appears with him, when she works with him, either just with piano or with orchestra, there's a freedom there, which I think is rather lovely, which we'll hear some of that later. All right, so we've just heard Flagstad in Die Walküre. That was in February 1935. Before the month was out, she had already added Isolde, which she had done before in Norway, but it was the first time she'd done it in America. And she made her personal debut as two of the three Brünnhildes. And she also sang Elsa in Lohengrin, she sang Elisabeth in Tannhäuser, and she sang her first ever Kundry. And many of these were with this conductor, Artur Bedanski, that I've talked about already, the Mahler disciple. And many of them also were with the Danish tenor Laurix Melchior, who became a kind of her regular partner in these things. And it was the icon, if you like, the sort of the duet icon of Flagstad and Melchior, which did so much to promote these Wagner performances, which were heard live at the Metropolitan Opera, which also toured a little around the country, didn't go very far, but stayed more on the east coast of America. But it was that partnership with Melchior that made this image of Wagner as a sellable, as a kind of commercial almost, a kind of entertaining proposition, which was very good for the Metropolitan because it coincided with rather a drop in their audiences and the interest in big opera. So she sort of revived that on her own and sort of revolutionised it, which I think was good. Also, it was very useful. I mean, in the way in which technological advances often go hand in hand with significant artistic achievement, it was good for us later on, and it was good for them then, that this coincided with these radio matinee broadcasts. Because that really got the word around. She was heard by many more people than could be heard even in a big barn of an opera house like the Metropolitan. Now, at the same time as appearing in the opera house, she followed a kind of tradition in foreign singers in the States, which goes right back to the Swedish singer Jenny Lind in the 1850s. Which is that, as well as appearing in the opera house, She also went out on the road. She also became a kind of gigging musician. And she would go, normally with the pianist Edwin MacArthur, and they really did go sort of everywhere. They went up to the borders of Canada, they went into Canada, they went right through the Central America, the Midwest and so on, the West Coast. And these were recitals, they were sort of song recitals. But she would, rather following the example of Jenny Lind, there was a very careful mixture of the classical and the more popular. She would tend to start with three groups of leader by, quotes, serious composers. There would be some Richard Strauss. There would be, in other times, there would be some Schubert and Schumann. She would then move on to Grieg, which was, of course, her country's native composer, and singing Grieg in Norwegian, in the States of America, at that time, in the later 1930s, going into the 1940s, became a very emotional and sort of almost deliberately patriotic experience, because it was the verge of the war, and it was while she was still in America that Nazi Germany invaded Norway and took over her country. So singing Grieg in Norwegian became a patriotic stand. It was rather like a French singer singing the Marseillaise. Let's have track number four, which is this is a Grieg song called Lis Nat. It's all very fine, it's a big voice and huge sound and it's a bargain, good for that. but she can't cope with these little songs. It's too much. She sort of swamps them. I completely disagree with that. I think you know, and I think that example sort of supports me. Also, it was through singing these songs, there's a very moving account by her herself of this, that she said, it was the first time that I really came to realise that people listened to the words. I think she was actually singing a recital in Copenhagen, and she was singing something in Norwegian. But she was just aware of the audience really listening so hard. And she said that, and that happened at more or less the same time as this performance we've just heard, which is about 1938. And she said that this then became a big influence on all her operatic work. And from that point onwards, she began to concentrate much more on the text than she had before. It wasn't sort of just a question of going out and sort of belting out huge sounds. You know, I can sing Hoya to Ho, like in the example we saw with Bob Hope. It was really beginning to work on the drama much more. Now, the other thing, just to pick up on that point, as you saw in the film we showed at the beginning, she was doing a lot of leaping around. She was like every strong beat, she was sort of getting the spear up. Now, she hated all that, right? She loathed all that. And she was already famous on stage for being remarkably still, kind of almost not acting at all, in the sense that people, including the Hollywood producers of that film, thought that sort of opera singers acted. And I mean, okay, very probably, if you look at some of the other film from the Metropolitan performances and other big operas in those days, they was right. The old cliche of opera singers can't act, they just stand around in a costume and wave their spears, wave their hats and so on. The old joke about the singer singing Wotan, who says to the director, I can so or so do. I mean, you know, spear here, spear there. I mean, it's very like what we saw in sort of Flagstaff there. But anyway, Hollywood sort of wanted to recuperate their sort of vision of what a real opera singer did. So they sort of made her leap around like that. But, I mean, in fact, in real life, if you look at some of the small clips we have of her on stage at this point, she's amazingly still. And that was a style that wasn't really taken over in opera and known in opera until we come right forward into the 1960s. I mean, in fact, just after Flagstaff's own death, when revolutionary directors like, for example, Wieland Wagner, the grandson of the composer, would have huge moments on stage in which nothing happened. Nothing happened. People were in wonderful positions, the lighting was great, the costume was great, but I mean, none of all this waving around. They would just be there, staring at each other. I mean, sort of dying with intensity, but not moving, leaping around. And I think we can credit some of that actually to Flagstaff. And it's no accident that of all the people who were involved with the Bayreuth Festival before the war, at the time when it was rather under the shadow of the Nazis, the only person that Wieland Wagner, the radical opera director, wanted back actually was Kirsten Flagstaff, because he'd seen that she was already moving in the direction of the kind of acting singer he wanted. I mean, emphasis being more on the acting, perhaps, than the singing. So I think she deserves a big credit for that, which I think is interesting. Now, on a slightly lighter side, as I mentioned to you already, at the start of her career, she did operettas, she did musicals, she did sort of flapper girl things, right? So she had some sort of very basic skills in sort of light entertainment. And although she was quite shy, and there's a very famous quote in which a director is directing her in a love scene, and he keeps on saying, you know, closer, embrace the girl more, look as if you mean it. And Flagstaff went, whoa, hold on. I mean, I must tell you that I must be the least kissed girl in Norway. which she thought, was sort of completely true of herself. But still, anyway, she'd sort of been through all this treadmill of, I mean, sort of the treadmill of light entertainment. So in fact, when she got to America, she found a natural link with all this. And she actually managed, in the 6 years she was there before she was forced to leave again because of the war, she managed to meet and to work with almost as many A-list, celebrities from the movie world and from the political world as she put on new sort of Wagner roles. And we also have the reports of her accompanist, Edwin MacArthur, that on the long train journeys to go for these gigs, she would read movie magazines like a real sort of obsessive. So starting off with this work with Bob Hope, she then actually, by the time she left America in 1941, she'd also worked with Bing Crosby, she'd been on the radio with Charlie Chaplin, she'd been on the radio with Herbert Hoover, and she'd been with her great Norwegian contemporary, the film star skater Sonja Henie. I don't know if any of you have ever seen any of Sonja Henie's movies. It's a sort of, they're amazing as a kind of kitsch item. It's like, you know, of course, every movie has to include a huge scene for skating, which you can show off her skating skills. Anyway, so she and Flagstad become great friends. And in fact, Flagstad also became the only Norwegian at that time, apart from Sonja Henie, to have a star on the famous Hollywood Walk of Fame, outside the Grauman's Theatre walkway there. So she was also... So the point I'm making here is that she was not, she was not slow in embracing the areas of what we would now call crossover, right? She saw that this was a world which she could relate to in the States. She wasn't just a sort of singer who was stuck in the metropolitan. So I think that's rather fun. Now, so by April 1941, at the Metropolitan, when she'd been in the American world for about 6 years, and she sang the role of Isolde 70 times there, in addition to all the other big Wagner roles and some of the Fidelio Leonoras, she had to make a very awkward decision, which was that she had to decide whether or not to go home so as to be with her husband. And her husband then, her second husband, was a Norwegian merchant and a Norwegian businessman called Henry Johansson. And he was rather right-wing politically, and he'd also got involved, directly with the Norwegian Quisling government, the sort of the proto-Nazi, proto-fascist government, in terms of sort of supplying materials to them. So it was a very dodgy position, but she felt she had to go and stand by him. So she left America, and she spent the next 4 years, the remaining 4 years of the war, in a kind of exile in Norway with him. And in that time, she only worked in Sweden and Switzerland, i.e. the two sort of supposedly Nazi countries. The two supposedly neutral countries. Although, in fact, they were quite sympathetic to the Nazi cause, as we now know. But she steered out of the occupied countries. So she tried to keep the spirit going, but it was a very difficult period for her. And it put a complete end to her work in America. And it also built up a great deal of hostility there. And it would actually be another 6.5 years before she came back to the States, before she could actually come back and start to work there again. And even then, all she could do to begin with was she could go back to doing these concert tours around the country with Edwin MacArthur, because none of the American opera houses were prepared to run the risk of taking someone whose possible sympathy with, possible attraction to the Nazi cause would cause, and actually did cause, huge demonstrations. And when she gave recitals at Carnegie Hall, she had to face rows and rows of demonstrators and with people screaming outside. Although probably, for as much as we know, this was just really carrying the cross for the husband. This is still being researched. I think there's still work is still being actually done on this period. Because I think that rather annoyingly, don't know if Tim agrees with me, there's still not really a good biography of Flagstad. I mean, it's kind of a bit of a mess. There's one which may be written or may be completed by this guy at the Metropolitan Opera, Robert Tuggle, but none of the Norwegian and none of the other sort of American works quite get the whole thing, either because they're sort of coy about the political side of it, the relationship with the husband, or because they ignore it completely and just concentrate on the music making and the records. So there are areas of the story which we still don't quite know. Anyway, the last stage of Flagstad's work in the Americas was actually heralded by her for the first time appearing actually outside North America. And she followed the route which many of the German singers and German conductors, who were in a slightly difficult position in 1945 because of ambiguity about their commitment to the Hitler regime or not, and they couldn't work at home anymore, and they weren't allowed to work in America anymore. So they went to Central America and to South America. So for the first time, Flagstad went to Cuba and she went to Argentina. And she sang in those countries which had a sort of residue of German population there and also had good links with German artists from maybe both sides. So we come to the rather extraordinary thing that her international return to the role of Tristan and Isolde actually takes place in Cuba.
Thank you.
There are two remarkable things there. One is the fact that it's a Cuban orchestra who are hardly familiar with the music. It's a very famous German conductor, Clemens Krauss, who's obviously worked very well with them, but I think there's a genuine atmosphere there. And you have a Norwegian soprano, Frank Svand, and you have the Swedish tenor, Seth Svanholm, who became her sort of replacement for Lauritz Melchior, and the person that she did most of her big Wagner work with in the 1940s and 1950s. But there I still think, and this is like a little flag and a little soapbox that I always wave about her, because I still think we get this wonderful idea of that she's singing a song. Okay, even if we switch kind of suddenly to the most to one of the most famous recordings of this piece that we could play you, a more modern recording, which is sung by the Swedish soprano Birgit Nilsson, what you really get at that point is you get sound, but there you have this terrific feeling of a real simple, basic emotion. I mean, I really believe she's in love, and I really believe that she's a real person in a situation of love. It's not some abstract night dream, which I think is a great achievement. So anyway, just to conclude briefly in one sentence, Flagstad, from her time in Cuba, and from an even longer period in Argentina, in the Teatro Colón House, Buenos Aires, where she worked with another very famous German conductor, Erich Kleiber, and they did Tristan, and they also did Götterdämmerung. From that point onwards, the pressure on the mainland American opera houses, North American opera houses, the Metropolitan, became too much. And when the Metropolitan Opera got an Austrian to be the head of their company, the famous Rudolf Bing, he said, "I have to have Flagstad back, and I don't care what she's done or what she's not done. I am in the business of presenting the greatest voices in the world. She's still absolutely one of the greatest voices in the world. She must come and sing here." So that was how she returned to New York and to the main opera stages. And she continued to sing there for another 3 years until she decided that she herself wanted to end her career singing opera. So that was effectively the end of her performing career in America in 1953. Although, because her daughter had married an American, she continued to have relationships with the country. So I think you've got this wonderful mixture, which I've tried to suggest a little, even in the short time, of someone who comes from nowhere and he makes an impact, which is always so welcome in a country like America. She makes an initial impact on the basis of sheer naked talent. She has a very big voice and she uses it very well. But she also, because she has this background in more commercial entertainment, she's able to use that by appearing in things like the bit of movie we saw at the beginning, and by appearing with all those Hollywood names. And also, because she likes communicating with people, and she was prepared to go on the road and work, and she went round as a gigging artist, to play in the much smaller places. So I think it's really quite an achievement to have those three lines going. And so, in fact, these days, when so much fuss is made about, so-and-so singing a pop song, or so-and-so singing a rock song, and they're supposed to be an opera singer, I mean, I'm not that wildly impressed, because I know that she was doing it in 1938. Okay, so that's the little story of Kirsten Flagstad in America.
Thank you.